This is the TED Radio Hour. Each week, groundbreaking TED Talks.
TED Talks.
TED.
TED.
Technology.
Entertainment.
Design.
Design. Is that really what it stands for? I've never known that.
Delivered at TED conferences around the world.
It's the gift of the human imagination.
We've had to believe in impossible things.
The true nature of reality beckons from just beyond.
Those talks, those ideas, adapted for radio. From NPR.
I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, The Way We Learn. And on a cold morning here in Washington, not so long ago, we called up Sugata Mitra. He was in Calcutta, where it's 110 degrees.
I'm afraid so.
My God. Are you inside?
I am inside, and it is a comfortable 105 in here.
Woo!
That should be fine, isn't it?
Now, the where of the story is important because in this very hot place, Sugata Mitra happened upon a discovery that, if proved true, could quite possibly transform the way we think about learning. So first, Sugata.
I'm a professor of educational technology at the University of Newcastle in England.
But most of his research over the past few decades has happened in India, and that's where he set out to prove that learning, it doesn't have to be taught. Call it unstoppable learning, something that happens at every stage in life. And on the show today, we'll hear from TED speakers who are trying to figure out how it happens, how our minds and even our bodies assimilate lessons from the world around us. So in Sugata's case, his story starts about two decades ago.
I am trained as a physicist, and I worked most of my early life as a software developer.
This was back in the early 1990s. Computers weren't as common, and Sugata was actually teaching courses in computer literacy.
These courses are expensive, so they are attended by students who have a lot of money.
Sugata would watch those students get to that moment, that gee whiz moment, when they'd solve a problem or figure out a technique, and he loved it.
Except that, I don't know why I used to feel a little uncomfortable about the fact that the gee whiz was getting to the rich kids and not getting to the poor kids. So wouldn't it be nice if there was some way to get it into the hands of the poorer kids and see what they do?
Nice thought. And for a couple of years, that's all it was. A nice thought. Until 1999. When Sugata was working in New Delhi.
And my boss actually wanted me to find out how kiosks, you know, computers in public spaces work, because they were just about coming in all over the world. And, you know, there were computers in airports and computers in railway stations. And he said, you know, this looks like big business. And I said, yeah, so shall I try it? And he said, yeah, go ahead and try it. And then I thought diabolically, here's my chance. Why don't I try it in the slum next door? And why don't I make it 3 feet off the ground rather than 4 or 5 feet? And this I did rather quietly and waited to see what would happen.
This is actual audio from Sugata's research of what happens when you stick a computer in a hole, in a wall, in a slum, with no running water, limited electricity, and crowded schools.
Just to see what would happen.
Here's Sugata's TED Talk.
If I gave a computer to children who never would have one, didn't know any English, didn't know what the internet was. The children came running in. It was 3 feet off the ground. And they said, what is this? And I said, yeah, it's, you know, I don't know. So they said, why have you put it there? I said, just like that. And they said, can we touch it? I said, if you wish to. And I went away.
So you went there and you put this in the wall of this village and you just left it there. You just walked away.
That was it, but it wasn't exactly walk away in the IT sense, because that computer was on a network. And I had a piece of software in those days called Remote Desktop. And I had that on in my computer in my office, so I could see the screen of the other computer from where I was. That screen remained static for hours and hours and hours. And then all of a sudden, it started to move and change. And then Microsoft Paint appeared on it. And then Microsoft Word appeared on it. You know, and then I saw words being written on that screen. And I couldn't believe it because there was no keyboard. So that's when I got up off my chair in my office and went rushing back to see what on earth they were doing, and discovered that they had actually figured out the character map, which I think even most users today, 15 years later, wouldn't know what that is. They'd figured that out, and they were using the character map to type things like, my name is Ankur, or something like that, on the screen.
It was incredible. In fact, it was almost a little too good to be true. So Sugata Mitra told a colleague.
My colleague said, no, it's a simple solution. One of your students must have been passing by, showed them how to use the mouse. So I said, yeah, that's possible. So I repeated the experiment. I went 300 miles out of Delhi into a really remote village where the chances of a passing software development engineer was very little. I repeated the experiment there. There was no place to stay, so I stuck my computer in. I went away, came back after a couple of months, found kids playing games on it. When they saw me, they said, we want a faster processor and a better mouse. So I said, how on earth do you know all this? And they said something very interesting to me. In an irritated voice, they said, you've given us a machine that works only in English, so we had to teach ourselves English in order to use it. That's the first time as a teacher that I heard the word teach ourselves said so casually.
And Sugata began to see that he had a chance to change the way we think about learning. Maybe learning, or the way we teach things to kids, maybe a lot of it can happen on its own, he thought, without any grown-ups around.
I'd stumbled on a certain way of learning which kids obviously knew how to do, and adults were not sure of how to use. And indeed, there were adults who said, it's totally unstructured. It's bits and pieces of information. Somebody even called it, I think somebody from the United States called it minimally effective education. So I was actually confused.
So Sugata set out to study just how effective this kind of learning was. He took his computers and he tried to repeat his experiment in different parts of India.
Which was really hard because, adults in those days in rural India, they said, are you sure you know what you're talking about? Our children are going to teach themselves how to use a computer. Come on, tell me something else.
But eventually, he convinced 18 different villages.
A village in Jammu and Kashmir called Gandharva, a place in western India in the deserts of Rajasthan called Khuri, a village called Pallam, on an unknown stretch of the most brilliant beach I've ever seen, a village in Karnataka, a couple of hundred kilometers from Bangalore, called, hold your breath, Kallu Devanahalli, which means the village of the black god, or something like that.
Over and over again, in each village,
Gandharva,
children standing in the summer heat,
Khuri,
would try to figure out how to use a computer.
Pallam.
And remember, the computer,
Kallu Devanahalli,
it wasn't even programmed in their native language.
And then we measured the children's computer literacy skills. We plotted it on a graph, and it was like an experiment in physics. It was straight up. Everywhere, exactly at the same rate. So I started publishing. I published everywhere. I wrote down and measured everything. And I said, in 9 months, a group of children left alone with a computer in any language would reach the same standard as an office secretary in the West. I'd seen it happen over and over and over again. But I was curious to know, what else would they do if they could do this much? How far will it go? Where does it stop? I decided I would destroy my own argument by creating an absurd proposition. And that's when I designed an experiment doomed to fail. Because I made an hypothesis which was absurd. The hypothesis was, can 12-year-old Tamil-speaking children in a village in southern India teach themselves the biotechnology of DNA replication in English 10 years ahead of their time, clustering around a roadside computer?
I don't know if med students at Harvard could teach themselves that.
Yeah, precisely. So I did that, you know, I was just gutted. I just thought, well, I know this is going to be very cruel, but somebody's got to do it. Somebody's got to say, look, there are some things you cannot do without a teacher. So I did the experiment. And I said, I'll measure them. They'll get a zero. I'll spend a couple of months. I'll leave it for a couple of months. I'll go back. They'll get another zero. I'll go back to the lab and say, we need teachers. The children came rushing and said, what's all this? So I said, it's very topical, very important. It's all in English. So they said, how can we understand such big English words and, you know, diagrams and chemistry? So by now, I had developed a new pedagogical method. So I applied that. I said, I haven't the foggiest idea. And anyway, I'm going away. So I came back after 2 months, and the children trooped in and said, we've understood nothing. So I said, well, I mean, what did I expect? So I said, okay, but how long did it take you before you decided that you can't understand anything? So they said, we haven't given up. We look at it every single day. So I said, what? You don't understand these screens, and you keep staring at it for 2 months. What for? So a little girl, she raised her hand, and she says to me in broken Tamil and English, she said, well, apart from the fact that improper replication of the DNA molecule causes disease, we haven't understood anything else. I've tried this in many, many schools. That's been tried all over the world. And teachers stand back and say, it just happens by itself? And I said, yeah, it happens by itself. How did you know that? And I said, you won't believe the children who told me and where they're from. So what's happening here? I think what we need to look at is we need to look at learning as the product of educational self-organization. If you allow the educational process to self-organize, then learning emerges. It's not about making learning happen, it's about letting it happen. The teacher sets the process in motion, and then she stands back in awe and watches as learning happens. I think that's what all this is pointing at.
Sugata Mitra. We'll hear more from him later in the show, including what he wants to do with this discovery. But coming up, another place where learning happens just by being there. I'm Guy Raz. You're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on the show today, unstoppable learning, how learning happens even when we're not aware of it.
And in that spirit, I want to spring on you all a pop quiz. Ready? When does learning begin?
This is from a TED Talk given by science writer Annie Murphy-Paul.
Now, as you ponder that question, maybe you're thinking about the first day of preschool or kindergarten. Or maybe you've called to mind the toddler phase when children are learning how to walk and talk and use a fork. Maybe you've encountered the 0 to 3 movement, which asserts that the most important years for learning are the earliest ones. Well, today I want to present to you an idea that may be surprising, that may even seem implausible, but which is supported by the latest evidence from psychology and biology. And that is that some of the most important learning we ever do happens before we're born, while we're still in the womb.
Annie's TED Talk was about this relatively new field of study called fetal origins.
And it's based on the theory that our health and well-being throughout our lives is crucially affected by the 9 months we spend in the womb. When we hold our babies for the first time, we might imagine that they're clean slates, unmarked by life, when in fact, they've already been shaped by us and by the particular world we live in. Today, I want to share with you some of the amazing things that scientists are discovering about what fetuses learn while they're still in their mother's bellies.
And it's really loud in there, right?
Oh, yeah. Because there's the woman's heart, ba-bum, 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 ba-bum. Her breathing, which is like, shh, her swallowing. There's a lot of sort of rushing sounds.
Like,
the woman's digestive system is right there.
It's like a symphony of organs.
Yes. And then, of course, her voice, which is probably booming. It sounds kind of like the teacher's voice in Charlie Brown. So it's really noisy in there.
They're coming out of like CBGB, and then when the babies come out, we're like, hello, baby. Hi, baby. But then, and they're like, why are you whispering? Because it was really loud.
Yeah, and they're like, this is weird. I'm going to cry. We tend to think of the fetus as sealed off in this bubble, but really they are here in the world with us.
Are they learning things in the womb that we can measure, or that we know they're learning?
Yes. We know that fetuses are learning in the sense of becoming familiar with certain stimuli. And let me give you an example, the sound of your mother's voice. Once the baby's born, it recognizes her voice, and it prefers listening to her voice over anyone else's. How can we know this? Newborn babies can't do much, but one thing they're really good at is sucking. Researchers take advantage of this fact by rigging up two rubber nipples so that if a baby sucks on one, it hears a recording of its mother's voice on a pair of headphones. And if it sucks on the other nipple, it hears a recording of a female stranger's voice. Babies quickly show their preference by choosing the first one. My favorite experiment of this kind is the one that showed that the babies of women who watched a certain soap opera every day during pregnancy recognized the theme song of that show once they were born. So fetuses are even learning about the particular language that's spoken in the world that they'll be born into. A study published last year found that from birth, from the moment of birth, babies cry in the accent of their mother's native language.
Okay, so Annie, we have some audio of a French baby and a German baby. Take a listen. This is the German baby. Okay, here is the French baby. Okay, let's do it again. German. French. Can you hear a difference?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, you can actually, can't you?
Sure. The French baby sounded like the inflection was kind of rising. And the German baby sounded like his or her cry was going down. Now, why would this kind of fetal learning be useful? It may have evolved to aid the baby's survival. From the moment of birth, the baby responds most to the voice of the person who is most likely to care for it, its mother. It even makes its cries sound like the mother's language, which may further endear the baby to the mother, and which may give the baby a head start in the critical task of learning how to understand and speak its native language. But it's not just sounds that fetuses are learning about in utero. It's also tastes and smells. By 7 months of gestation, the fetus's taste buds are fully developed, and its olfactory receptors, which allow it to smell, are functioning. The flavors of the food a pregnant woman eats find their way into the amniotic fluid, which is continuously swallowed by the fetus. Babies seem to remember and prefer these tastes once they're out in the world. In one experiment, a group of pregnant women was asked to drink a lot of carrot juice during their third trimester of pregnancy, while another group of women, pregnant women, drank only water. 6 months later, the women's infants were offered cereal mixed with carrot juice, and their facial expressions were observed while they ate it. The offspring of the carrot juice drinking women ate more carrot flavored cereal, and from the looks of it, they seemed to enjoy it more. A sort of French version of this experiment was carried out in Dijon, France, where researchers found that mothers who consumed food and drink flavored with licorice-flavored anise during pregnancy showed a preference for anise on their first day of life, and again when they were tested later on their fourth day of life. Babies whose mothers did not eat anise during pregnancy showed a reaction that translated roughly as, yuck. What this means is that fetuses are effectively being taught by their mothers about what is safe and good to eat. Fetuses are also being taught about the particular culture that they'll be joining through one of culture's most powerful expressions, which is food. They're being introduced to the characteristic flavors and spices of their culture's cuisine even before birth.
Things like the woman's diet, the woman's stress level, even the woman's sort of mental state, these things can be communicated to the fetus, and they are incredibly plastic, they're incredibly malleable, and they're already preparing for exactly the sort of environment that they're going to enter even before their very first day on Earth.
That's unbelievable.
One of my favorite findings is that eating chocolate when you're pregnant seems to be connected to having a happier baby.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You know, I researched and wrote this book when I was pregnant with my second child, and I took that as license to eat as much chocolate as I wanted. And he is quite a happy baby, I should say.
Fetal origins research is about discovering how best to promote the health and well-being of the next generation. That important effort must include a focus on what fetuses learn during the 9 months they spend in the womb. Learning is one of life's most essential activities, and it begins much earlier than we ever imagined. Thank you.
Science writer Annie Murphy-Paul. Check out her full talk at TED.com. So imagine just how much activity is happening in your brain in those 9 months, right? Well, that may be nothing compared to what comes next, which brings us to Allison Gopnik.
I'm a professor in the Department of Psychology at University of California at Berkeley and an affiliate professor of philosophy at Berkeley as well.
And?
And I study babies and young children and what they can tell us about what it means to be human. After all, we're just babies and young children that have been around a little bit longer.
Yeah, we're like giant babies and not as easy to like.
Not as cute and probably not as smart either.
Yeah, really?
Yeah.
Now, when it comes to understanding a baby's brain, Allison Gopnik says we are in the midst of a scientific revolution. And when she started her TED Talk, she pointed to a photo of a baby.
What is going on in this baby's mind? If you'd asked people this 30 years ago, most people, including psychologists, would have said that this baby was irrational, illogical, egocentric, that he couldn't take the perspective of another person or understand cause and effect.
That was the picture of children for a really long time, both in science and philosophy, that somehow children were adults with pieces missing.
And now, she says the minds of babies are like the minds of
the most brilliant scientists.
The most brilliant scientist.
Even these tiny babies are already doing a lot of the kinds of thinking and learning that we think of as being the learning of very sophisticated scientists. If you just pretty much take a random 15-month-old, just sit and watch them for 10 minutes and count up how many experiments, how much thinking you see going on, and it will put the most brilliant scientists to shame.
What would they do in just a matter of 10 minutes?
Well, let me give you the example of going for a walk with Augie, my grandson. What does Augie do? Well, the first thing that he does is he sees that there's a little brick path that goes off to one side. And actually, if you climb up, you can get up one step of that brick path. So then he tries to get up the step, and then he tries it again, and then he tries it again. But then he notices that there's actually some flowers, really actually dandelions, but flowers as far as he's concerned, that are off in the grass. So then he has to lean over and try and see, are those flowers the same as the flowers that he's seen before? And can you actually blow on them the same way you blow on other dandelions? Then he'll suddenly say, Plane? Plane? And he hears the plane that's way up out of the in the distant corner that I haven't even paid any attention to. He's observing and experimenting and trying to come to grips with all of these things that we just take for granted because we learned about them when we were 15 months old. And if you just look at children's exploratory play, just their, you know, getting into everything, it turns out that they're actually getting into everything in a way that is systematic and will tell them about how things work out there in the world.
I think babies and children are actually more conscious than we are as adults. Adult attention and consciousness look kind of like a spotlight. Our consciousness of that thing that we're attending to becomes extremely bright and vivid, and everything else sort of goes dark. If we look at babies and young children, we see something very different. Seem to have more of a lantern of consciousness than a spotlight of consciousness. So babies and young children are very bad at narrowing down to just one thing. But they're very good at taking in lots of information from lots of different sources at once. And if you actually look in their brains, you see that they're flooded with these neurotransmitters that are really good at inducing learning and plasticity, and the inhibitory parts haven't come on yet.
But how do we really know they're learning all this stuff? It's obviously not easy to ask a baby. So Alison Gopnik started to think about a way to approach it.
Maybe we could ask children about what they think about other people by using some very, very simple facts about little babies, which is that they like to eat some things and they don't like to eat other things. They really like goldfish crackers, for example, and they really don't like raw broccoli. So we thought, well, maybe we could take this very basic fact and find a way to ask whether they understood what somebody else wanted.
So Alison tried this out with a bunch of babies, including this one, Nathan.
What we did, first of all, was take a little bit of food from each bowl.
Yeah, that's broccoli. And what's that? That's crackers.
And make a kind of exaggerated version of either a disgusted face or a happy face.
Broccoli.
And, oh, yuck! Crackers.
I don't like crackers.
And
then
give the baby the two bowls of food and say,
can I have some?
Can you give me some?
Could you give me some of what I like?
When you liked the broccoli instead of the crackers, the 18-month-olds would actually give to the broccoli.
Thank you, Mom. Thank you so much.
So they seem to still think, okay, I like crackers, but this other person, strange though it may seem, this other person likes broccoli. And if they like broccoli, I should give them broccoli.
Which means that they're starting to become empathetic.
Well, in a way, they were going beyond empathy. They were actually being altruistic. They were actually taking into account the perspective of the other person. Now, one of the interesting things is that the 15-month-olds actually didn't do that. The 15-month-olds only gave the crackers. So it seemed as if they had somehow learned to do that between the time they were 15 months and the time they were 18 months.
But when you think about it, 18 months, I mean, that's a long time, especially when you compare us to other mammals.
Why would we have this long period when we're completely incompetent and when our parents have to put so much time and energy into taking care of us? I mean, it's kind of an evolutionary paradox. One idea, which I think you actually see across the animal kingdom, is that that early period of apparent uselessness is there because it gives us this capacity to explore. Childhood is a separate evolutionary stage of what it is to be a human being.
We have bigger brains relative to our bodies by far than any other animal. We're smarter, we're more flexible, we can learn more, we survive in more different environments. And our babies and children are dependent on us for much longer than the babies of any other species. My son is 23, and at least until they're 23, we're still popping those worms into those little open mouths.
Alison, when does it end? When does that, like, extreme phase of learning just stop?
Well, I don't think it ever stops. That's kind of the good news. So, of course, if we stayed, like, my adorable 15-month-old grandson forever, then we'd need to have parents and grandparents taking care of us all the time. That would not actually be a functional way to be an adult. Sometimes I say going to the 7-Eleven to get a pint of milk with Augie is like going for a walk with William Blake. Suddenly, the amazingness and awesomeness of the universe in the grain of sand is vivid to you as an adult. And if you've ever lived with an incredibly creative genius romantic poet, you might think that there are some drawbacks to that as well as advantages. So we do eventually have to grow up.
Now, it's good to be a grown-up. I don't want to say too much about how wonderful babies are. It's good to be a grown-up. We can do things like tie our shoelaces and cross the street by ourselves. And it makes sense that we put a lot of effort into actually making babies think like adults do. But if what we want is to have open-mindedness, open learning, imagination, creativity, innovation, maybe at least some of the time we should be getting the adults to start thinking more like children.
That's Allison Gopnik. You can find her full talk at ted.npr.org. Last night I was putting my 4-year-old to bed and he just said, "Daddy, can you tell me everything about the world?" And I said, "Everything?" He said, "Yeah, can you tell me everything about the world?" Our show today, Unstoppable Learning. I'm Guy Raz, and this is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Stay with us. Hey, if you like movies, TV shows, books, music, and more, check out the Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. It's a smart weekly discussion about all those things. You can find NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour on iTunes under podcasts. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on the show today, we're talking to TED speakers about how learning happens, how ultimately it's an unstoppable process. And as we heard from Sugata Mitra earlier in the show, learning doesn't happen in a vacuum. It still depends on making a connection between a child and his mother, or between two kids, or even a student and her teacher.
We learn from the environments that we live in, which includes people. So I don't think we do anything on our own or alone.
This is Rita Pearson. She's been an educator for more than 40 years, and when she gave her talk at TED Talks Education, she spoke about the power of human connection and how it impacts learning. Here's her talk.
I have spent my entire life either at the schoolhouse, on the way to the schoolhouse, or talking about what happens in the schoolhouse. And so needless to say, over those years, I've had a chance to look at education reform from a lot of perspectives. And we know why kids drop out. We know why kids don't learn. It's either poverty, low attendance, negative peer influences, low influence with parents. We know why. But one of the things that we never discuss, or we rarely discuss, is the value and importance of human connection, relationships. George Washington Carver says all learning is understanding relationships. For years, I have watched people teach. I have looked at the best, and I've looked at some of the worst. A colleague said to me one time, "They don't pay me. They don't pay me to like the kids. They pay me to teach a lesson. The kids should learn it. I should teach it. They should learn it. Case closed." Well, I said to her, "You know, kids don't learn from people they don't like." I have had classes that were so low, so academically deficient that I cried. I wondered, how am I going to take this group in 9 months from where they are to where they need to be? How do I raise the self-esteem of a child and his academic achievement at the same time? I gave a quiz, 20 questions. Student missed 18. I put a +2 on his paper and a big smiley face. He said, "Miss Pearson, is this an F?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Then why'd you put a smiley face?" I said, "'Cause you on the roll. You got 2 right, you didn't miss them all." I said, "And when we review this, won't you do better?" He said, yes, ma'am, I can do better. You see, minus 18 sucks all the life out of you. Plus 2 said, I ain't all bad.
I love that. I love that you did that to that kid's test.
I don't know why we celebrate failure. Somewhere along the line, we started to think that if I point out to you what you don't do or you didn't do, it will inspire you to do.
Yeah.
That doesn't make sense to me.
Hmm.
If I tell you what you've done right, it inspires you to do something else that's right. I want my students to always see the value of possibility. And that's what I wanted him to see, that I am worth more, I can do more, I am more. Plus 2 said that. Minus 18 would not have said that.
4 years I watched my mother take the time at recess to review, go on home visits in the afternoon, buy combs and brushes and peanut butter and crackers to put in a desk drawer for kids that needed to eat, and a washcloth and some soap for the kids who didn't smell so good. See, it's hard to teach kids who stink. And kids can be cruel. And so she kept those things in her desk. And years later, after she retired, I watched some of those same kids come through and say to her, you know, Miss Walker, you made a difference in my life. You made it work for me. You made me feel like I was somebody when I knew at the bottom I wasn't. And I want you to just see what I've become. And when my mama died 2 years ago at 92, there were so many former students at her funeral. It brought tears to my eyes, not because she was gone, but because she left a legacy of relationships that could never disappear. Can we stand to have more relationships? Absolutely. Will you like all your children? Of course not. And while you won't like them all, the key is they can never, ever know it. We teach anyway, because that's what we do. Teaching and learning should bring joy. How powerful would our world be if we had kids who were not afraid to take risks, who were not afraid to think, and who had a champion? Every child deserves a champion, an adult who will never give up on them, who understands the power of connection and insists that they become the best that they can possibly be. Is this job tough? You betcha. But it is not impossible. We can do this. We're educators. We're born to make a difference. Thank you so much.
That's Rita Pearson's TED Talk. And Rita, we heard from Sugata Mitra earlier in the show, and we're going to hear a bit more from him in a few minutes. And, you know, and he talks a lot about how sometimes adults just get in the way. They don't allow kids to just kind of figure it out and learn on their own.
And to a degree, that's true. Sometimes I think we do need to be quiet and say, okay, let's see what you come up with. Let's see what your idea is. Tell me how you would figure this out. So, yes, it is very, very true that sometimes adults do get in the way of learning, but they cannot be absent from learning.
Can learning happen without that?
I don't think so. And I may be wrong. Children thrive on structure, but freedom. But I think that it is reassuring for children to know that while I may not always want an adult in my business, so to speak, I want to know a positive and nurturing adult is there if I need them.
Rita, that kid who missed 18 questions, did he ever get better?
Of course he did. I insisted that he did. Learning sometimes occurs because someone insists that you recognize the excellence in yourself. Sometimes it's as simple as, I know you can do this. I feel like you are better than you showed me on that paper. Let's learn how positive and potent you are together. So, yes, he did better. Of course he did.
That's Rita Pearson. She gave her talk at TED Talks Education. It aired on PBS. And just a few months after that TED Talk and our interview, Rita Pearson passed away in 2013. She'd worked in education for more than 40 years. Now, here's the thing about learning, the thing that connects the dots. It doesn't matter whether it's a fetus or an infant or a child or an adult. There has to be some type of human-to-human connection for it all to work, which is what Sugata Mitra found out when he started to dig deeper into how we learn. So remember how he stuck that computer in a wall in a slum in New Delhi?
In fact, after the first day, I had to shut the computer down after sunset because the mothers were complaining that the kids wouldn't come home.
What those mothers didn't understand, what Sugata initially didn't understand himself, was that the kids were teaching themselves. Those kids with no access to technology, they were typing, they were playing games, they were teaching themselves biology and English, all with a machine they had never used before. And it got Sugata thinking about the way all children learn. Here's how he explained it in his TED Talk.
If you look at present-day schooling the way it is, it's quite easy to figure out where it came from. It came from about 300 years ago. Imagine trying to run the show, trying to run the entire planet without computers, without telephones, with data handwritten on pieces of paper and traveling by ships. But the Victorians actually did it. What they did was amazing. They created a global computer made up of people. It's still with us today. It's called the bureaucratic administrative machine. In order to have that machine running, you need lots and lots of people. They made another machine to produce those people, the school. The schools would produce the people who would then become parts of the bureaucratic administrative machine. They must have good handwriting because the data is handwritten. They must be able to read, and they must be able to do multiplication, division, addition, and subtraction in their head. They must be so identical that you could pick one up from New Zealand and ship them to Canada, and he would be instantly functional. So what are we doing with that design that produces these identical people? It's quite fashionable to say that the education system is broken. It's not broken. It's wonderfully constructed. It's just that we don't need it anymore. It's outdated. What's the kind of jobs that we have today? Well, the clerks are the computers. They're there in thousands in every office. And you have people who guide those computers to do their clerical jobs. Those people don't need to be able to write beautifully by hand. They don't need to be able to multiply numbers in their heads. They do need to be able to read. In fact, they need to be able to read discerningly. But that's today. What will it be tomorrow? Could it be that we don't need to go to school at all? Could it be that at the point in time when you need to know something, you can find out in 2 minutes? Could it be a devastating question that we are heading towards or maybe in a future when knowing is obsolete?
A future where knowing is obsolete? I mean, could it ever be obsolete?
Well, yeah. Actually, I love that question. Is knowing obsolete? We are in an age where knowing is not a big deal. And therefore, the current assessment system of examinations is ridiculous because it relies on the old Victorian concept of knowledge being resident inside the human brain in a form such that it is reproducible at a moment's notice. But our children are not growing up in that age. They're growing up in an age where everything that humanity has ever known is inside their pockets. And we're telling them, no. Don't keep staring at your mobile phone all the time and you know, don't huddle up with your computer all the time. Read a book. I don't know if we're doing the right thing.
I don't want my kid in front of the internet all the time. I mean, we limit that time. We want them in front of books. Is that wrong?
I don't know, but I would say I agree with the first part of what you said, that you don't want him huddled over his computer all the time. But I would say instead, maybe you and he and maybe a couple of other fathers and mothers and a couple of other children, maybe you could all get together with a really big screen and drift free into cyberspace altogether. You could take something that's really, really important. So what's so great about the Higgs boson, and why is everybody spending billions of dollars on the Higgs boson when people don't have enough to eat? You try spending an evening
researching that with a couple of 13-year-olds or 10-year-olds or whatever, I can tell you, you won't regret it.
That sounds like a fun night, actually. I might do that. I'm serious.
Yeah. Well, try it. I have a name for it. It's called a self-organized learning environment.
Self-organized learning environment. Sugata calls them souls, and he wants to build schools that are more like souls all over the world. But what would they look like, and who would be there to supervise? Well, Sugata stumbled on a possible answer during his research in India. It was in a village called Kalikupam, and the children there were using his computers. They had learned a pretty impressive amount on their own about DNA replication, but at a certain point, they hit a wall. They just couldn't improve.
How do I get them to pass? I have to get them 20 more marks. I couldn't find a teacher. What I did find was a friend that they had, a 22-year-old girl who was an accountant, and she played with them all the time. So I asked this girl, can you help them? So she says, absolutely not. I didn't have science in school. I have no idea what they're doing under that tree all day long. I can't help you. I said, I'll tell you what, use the method of the grandmother. So she says, what's that? I said, stand behind them. Whenever they do anything, you just say, well, wow, I mean, how did you do that? What's the next page? Gosh, when I was your age, I could have never done that. I mean, you know what grannies do. So she did that for 2 more months. The scores jumped to 50%. Kalikuppam had caught up with my control school in New Delhi, a rich private school with a trained biotechnology teacher. When I saw that graph, I knew there is a way to level the playing field. Encouragement seems to be the key. If you look at Kuppam, if you look at all of the experiments that I did, it was simply saying, wow, saluting learning. There is evidence from neuroscience. The reptilian part of our brain, which sits in the center of our brain, when it's threatened, it shuts down everything else. It shuts down the prefrontal cortex, the parts which learn. It shuts all of that down. Punishment and examinations are seen as threats. We take our children, we make them shut their brains down, and then we say, perform. Why did they create a system like that? Because it was needed. There was an age, in the age of empires, when you needed those people who can survive under threat. When you're standing in a trench all alone, if you could have survived, you're okay, you passed. If you didn't, you failed. But the age of empires is gone. We need to shift that balance back from threat to pleasure. We don't want to be spare parts for a great human computer, do we? So we need to design a future for learning. My wish is to help design a future of learning by supporting children all over the world to tap into their wonder and their ability to work together. Help me build this school. It'll be called a school in the cloud. It'll be a school where children go on these intellectual adventures driven by the big questions which their mediators put in. The way I want to do this is to build a facility where I can study this. It's a facility which is practically unmanned. The lights are turned on and off by the cloud, etc., etc. Everything's done from the cloud. And just one last thing. I'll take you to the top of the Himalayas. At 12,000 feet, where the air is thin, I once built 2 computers. The children flocked there. There was this little girl who was following me around. And I said to her, you know, I want to give a computer to everybody, every child. I don't know, what should I do? And I was trying to take a picture of her, you know, quietly. She suddenly raised a hand like this and said to me, get on with it. Thank you very much.
Sugata Mitra. And that wish to build souls all over the world? Well, it's on its way to becoming a reality. Sugata was awarded the 2013 TED Prize, $1 million toward his goal of revolutionizing the future of learning. You can find out more about that at TED.com/prize. Waiting for the man to come and go away.
Hey, thanks for listening to the show this week. If you missed any of it, or if you want to hear more, you want to find out more about who was on it, you can visit ted.npr.org. You can also find many more TED Talks at ted.com. You can download the show through iTunes or through the NPR smartphone app. Our program was produced by Jeff Rogers, Brent Bachman, Megan Kane, Neva Grant, and Sanaz Meshkinpour, with help from Portia Robertson-Migas and Eric Newsom. Thanks to our partners at TED, Chris Anderson, June Cohen, Darren Triff, and Janet Lee. I'm Guy Raz. You've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading here on the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Hey, if you have a moment, check out another NPR podcast. It's called Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's a smart weekly discussion about the latest movies and TV shows, books, music, and more. You can find NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour on iTunes under podcasts.